Hello and welcome to ETY Podcast, Voices on the World of Work. I'm your host, Bianca Luna Fabris, and in this episode, we will be focusing on what has been happening in terms of social policies at a European level throughout this past year. The podcast stems from our recent publication, Bilan Social, and we have the pleasure of having with us the two editors of the book, Bart van Erke and Slavina Spasova from the European Social Observatory. In the show notes, you will be able to find a link to the publication that is available both in English and in French, and a few other links that we think you might enjoy. So Bart, maybe I would actually like to start with a question for you. In a nutshell, could you perhaps outline which policy shift has taken place in EU social policymaking throughout this past year?
Yes, I'll be happy to start. Thank you, Bianca, also for having us today. So much has happened since last year. Just think of it. The cover of our book starts with this sentence. The European Union is currently fighting on two main fronts, COVID-19 and climate change. Looking at the cover here, we could never, of course, have imagined that merely a few weeks later, an actual war is being fought on the European continent. This is really stunning, and as a consequence, as we know, of course, the biggest refugee crisis since the Second World War is now unfolding, with over 1.5 million people having fled their homes, and it would seem that the worst is yet to come. But I'll move to your question regarding EU social policymaking, because of course that's what you're inquiring about. You're right that important policy shifts took place since we spoke last year, notably regarding fiscal policies, on climate change, the digital agenda, and of course also health policy. So I'll just maybe say a few words about EU fiscal policies, because this is, of course, very important in an EU context. We have a chapter in the book by Cinzia Alcidi and Francesco Corti that shows very nicely that the pandemic broke several long-standing taboos in this area with regard to fiscal policies. I'll just name a few. The Stability and Growth Pact, one of the EU's holy cows, as you remember, is still on hold. The member states finally took the first step towards the creation of a fiscal stabilization instrument, which is called SURE in the EU jargon. And then there is, of course, this vast EU recovery program. Hang on to your seat. It's worth 1.8 trillion euros, and it will be partially funded through the issuance of common EU debt. That is quite extraordinary. So, in a nutshell, even though it was hard fought, including with the Frugal Four that we discussed also last year, the EU showed strong solidarity, which was just unimaginable before the pandemic. But there's even more. The EU is now pushing member states towards public investments rather than towards austerity. And imagine the contrast there with the management of the 2008 financial crisis. Of course, the question is, as always, whether these measures are pointing to a lasting shift or even a paradigm shift, because most measures that I just listed are, of course, temporary. And therefore, they remain to some extent fragile.
And we were talking about this just before we started recording this podcast. So what about climate change?
Thanks for bringing it up. In December 2019, the European Green Deal was tabled by the European Commission, it was presented as a policy shift regarding our dependence on economic growth to maintain prosperity and well-being. And we have a chapter in the book by Hans Brönnings and colleagues from the European Environment Agency, which argues, I would say convincingly, that the Green Deal has been strengthened rather than weakened by COVID-19. And indeed, what we see now is that member states have allocated almost 40% of the vast amounts, which I've just mentioned, and are available through the EU Recovery and Resilience Facility, to exactly climate measures. And that's even more than the target that was previously agreed. Again, you know, we shouldn't be naive. The Green Deal legislative pace has been slowing down during 2021. And we know that massive funding is going to be needed to cover the social costs of the just transition. So we also know that especially lower income regions are going to pay a high price for this. Again, it would seem that the war in Ukraine will impact that EU agenda? We just heard European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans explain or announcing that the EU wants to slash Russian gas dependence by 2/3 this year. And so, ironically perhaps, this war may in fact end up further strengthening the EU's climate ambitions.
Bart mentioned a third important shift, so the digital translation. Slavina, perhaps you would like to comment on this point?
Good morning, Bianca, and thank you very much for the invitation. And indeed, managing the digital transition is a top priority for the von der Leyen Commission, which has again been further spurred on by COVID-19. And under the slogan, "A Europe Fit for the Digital Age," major key legislative initiatives have been put on the EU agenda, which aim to regulate data, digital services, and digital markets. And a key question here to ask is, what are the social and labor market implications of this technological shift? And in the book, Aida Ponce del Castillo explains that the discourse of the European Commission is that digitalization will improve productivity, work efficiency, and will create new opportunities for both the economy and citizens. However, especially the trade unions, but also some new social movements have been stressing that there are social risks involved, which should be seriously considered. And let me, Bianca, just mention some of them, which are very important: the labor rights and social security situation of platform workers, the genuine participation of the social partners in managing the digital transition, and the algorithmic management with a human face. So, at the end of the day, what we need to prevent is the rise of an underclass of platform workers.
And then, if I can call it this way, the elephant in the room, so EU health policy. I believe your book argues that the pandemic has acted as a catalyst moment in your field. And perhaps, Bart, you want to take the floor here?
Yes, indeed, you've got that right, Bianca. Very important changes are taking place regarding health policy. The EU has to some extent also taken a much stronger coordination and steering role in the past year in the field of health. And this is, again, thanks to some extent, or because of COVID-19. We have a chapter in the book by Thibaut Duruel, who calls this change a paradigm and institutional shift. Again, the question is, of course, whether these changes are here to stay or temporary. Because, yes, we know that the Commission now advocates very strongly a European Health Union, as they call it. But this, a change towards such a health union, would mean that powers on public health would need to be shared between the member states and the EU, which is, of course, not the case now. And we all know how difficult treaty changes are, especially now that 10 member states have already flagged that boosting EU powers in health is simply a no-go area.
So the book clearly flags winners and losers from the pandemic, but maybe you could explain to us in lay terms what this means and who these winners and losers are. And maybe, Slavina, you want to take this question?
Indeed, Bianca, this is among the central questions of this year's Bilan Social. So when we started the book last year, we knew that evidence would be scarce, but we absolutely wanted to make a first evaluation in exactly these terms. Who are the winners and who are the losers from the economic measures taken during the pandemic? The end result is quite telling, as we read in the chapter by Michael Dauderstadt. And to put it bluntly, Bianca, they are mainly losers and only a few winners. And if we look at the national level, sectors such as transport, accommodation, and food services declined by at around 80% in 2020. And there was a collapse in tourism. You are not surprised to hear that. And employment in countries such as Spain, Italy, Portugal, and Croatia collapsed for certain months. And in these countries, the sector of tourism represents a large share of their economy. So unsurprisingly, the southern countries of Europe are the biggest losers from the pandemic. What about the population groups? Those who were the hardest hit by the pandemic are, again, I suppose, unsurprisingly to you, young people, women, and people on a low income. So those under the age of 25 were among the biggest losers of the crisis, also because there was already high unemployment in this group before the pandemic. So youth unemployment rose sharply to a dramatic 18% in August 2020. Moreover, we all know that young people also suffered a lot from the successive lockdowns as they lost their societal markers. Going to school, to university, having a social life with friends, and in general, being involved in society. So all of this has been put on hold with far-reaching consequences for young people's mental well-being. And so for good reasons, the EU proclaimed 2020 the European Year of Youth. Let's see the impact of the main initiatives, if any. And then last, but well, obviously not least, women. We women have been also among the main losers of the pandemic, partly because of caring responsibilities. And also, as I mentioned before, the sectors of accommodation and food services were hard hit by the crisis, where women are overrepresented. Let me also mention the situation which was even worse in domestic services, where employment fell dramatically in 2020, while nearly 9 in 10 workers in this sector are women. In sum, we have not all been in the same boat as regards COVID, and measures are needed to remedy the detrimental long-term effects.
Would you then say that the member states have not done what was needed to alleviate economic unemployment losses that were triggered by the pandemic?
No, I'd say on the contrary. The situation would have been much worse if there had not been unprecedented economic and social support provided by the member states, although this varied a lot between countries. As Bart already mentioned, there have been also unprecedented measures at the EU level, so we avoided an economic and labor market disaster. We know about all these large-scale measures, such as job retention schemes, which were introduced in all member states. And here I'd like to briefly mention that the European Social Policy Network, ESP, and the European Social Observatory, ETUI, have done comprehensive research on different types of measures. So at the end of the day, these measures prevented mass layoffs and kept poverty risk in check. And the result is that both market and disposable income inequality changed only slightly. So at the end of the day, the pandemic seems just to have slowed down the previous decline in inequality, which started in 2017. And let's not forget, I've just talked about that, about these vulnerable groups. The pandemic also flagged significant loopholes in our social protection and social inclusion systems, which will need to be addressed in the coming years. And finally, if I could, I'd like to underline an interesting development, which is that in the RRF, each social measure that includes a focus on children and young people and on gender equality must be flagged now by the member states. This will allow for specific reporting on expenditure focused on these three dimensions. So one can only hope that this will somehow remedy the lack of quantified social targets in the EU's recovery plan. Well, let's see.
So, Slovena, you have very clearly laid out to us who are the losers from the pandemic. But you did mention en passant that there are some winners as well. So maybe you could tell us who they are.
Indeed, I've been depicting a gloomy picture. Definitely, there are some winners. So due to the increased use of digital tools and more generally the acceleration of digitalization, the winners included, unsurprisingly, online retail and communication software sectors. And moreover, due to the health nature of the crisis, there was increased demand in some branches of the health and care sectors. I won't surprise you, we all heard of that. Another significant winner is the housing sector, and especially for investors. We all know that housing prices have been skyrocketing in the EU. So this development is expected to lead to increased rental market inequalities as income is being redistributed from relatively poorer tenants to relatively richer owners.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much. So it's very clear who the winners and losers are at a national level, but what about the European dimension? Who are the winners and losers at a supranational level? And maybe, Bart, you want to take this one?
Yes, I think we can identify some winners at the EU level as well. And in fact, I sort of already refer to some of them. For example, in the chapter which Amy Verdand and I wrote in this book, we found that within the European Commission, the Secretariat General of the Commission, but also the Directorate General for Economic and Financial Affairs, which is called DG ECFIN in the EU jargon, clearly strengthened their internal position by steering the new recovery and resilience facility. By contrast, and I think this is quite alarming also from a trade union point of view, is that in the initial months after the launch of the EU recovery, the social affairs ministers, their advisory committees, but also the employment and social affairs department of the commission, DG EMPL as it's called, in fact lost most or much of the ground which they had gained slowly but certainly during the past decade in the context of the European semester. And a quite similar situation, maybe again a bit gloomy, is apparent for trade unions, but also for business representatives, which we together call, of course, the social partners. They have been heard by the EU institutions in the context of the EU recovery, but they've not really been listened to during the past year and a half. And this is really worrying. And the situation is even worse with regard to civil society organizations, you know, EU-wide non-governmental organizations, etc. They have been completely sidelined in regard to the EU recovery. Just to cite one of our respondents, Bianca, who explained to us last year, the EU did not even pretend to be listening to us. I think this is quite telling. And all of this is quite shocking, given the fact that the regulation on the recovery and resilience facility in fact obliges member states, and this is important and it's new, it obliges member states to report on how they consulted with their stakeholders to write up their national plans. But clearly, this didn't have any practical effects just yet. By contrast, I should mention that the southern, as well as the central and eastern European countries, which Slavina rightly pointed out as the losers of the pandemic, are clearly winners as regards the recovery and resilience fund. That is, if they can absorb the planned massive increase in public investment. Maybe just to identify one or two more important winners at the EU level, to which I already referred. First of all, the health policy actors have clearly used the crisisification of EU health policy making during COVID-19 to expand the role of the EU in this field. That is very clear in the chapter by De Ruel. But as importantly, Aida Pons del Castillo from ETY warns that some of the new movements and some of the new players who try to steer this debate on the digital transition, to which Lavina referred, have become in fact more influential at the EU level than trade unions and other more traditional stakeholders. I think this is really something that we should be careful about. A final point about winners and losers relates to the green transition. We know for a fact that there will be winners and losers. But to be honest, we have not been able to clearly identify them yet. What we do know is that the war in Ukraine will further aggravate the skyrocketing energy prices, which will especially hit vulnerable groups and which will create greater problems of energy poverty.
Since we recorded our last podcast episode, and I believe it was January 2021, what has come up on the social agenda? What are the big topics?
Yes, in this respect, I'd like to highlight three main initiatives. The first one, unsurprisingly, is the action plan of the European Pillar of Social Rights, which was endorsed in May 2021 by the EU institutions, the European social partners, and European civil society representatives. And this uniquely broad support gives strong political legitimacy to the port to social commitment, as it is called in the EU jargon. And we can clearly state that this plan has revamped the EU's social ambitions and led to the adoption of, we all know, the new EU headline targets for employment, skills and social inclusion, and a European child guarantee. And it also provided a push for the platform for combating homelessness, a revised version of the pillar social scoreboard, and several initiatives around equality, including gender equality. And moreover, the fact that the action plan is backed by significant financial resources gives it additional bite. Then secondly, and arguably the most ambitious EU social policy initiative since the start of the pandemic, is the Commission's proposed directive on adequate minimum wages. As you know, as it was labeled by Thorsten Müller, who is one of your colleagues at ETUI, he called it a watershed in the history of European social and economic integration. And I think he's right, as this is the first time the Commission is starting work on legislation, not only to promote adequate levels of statutory minimum wages, but also to promote collective bargaining on wage setting and to improve effective access to minimum wage protection. And then the third initiative I would like to highlight is the directive on platform work, the proposal for a directive on platform work, which addresses key concerns that have spilled over from national debates regarding platform work. And one of the major purposes of the proposed directive is to improve working conditions of platform workers by ensuring that their employment status is correctly identified. So, indeed, the Commission's proposal is really ambitious, and let's see what the final agreement will look like.
Thank you very much, Slavina. And I think it's I'm eager to see how things are going to develop on the directive on minimum wages, specifically as the French presidency has been very vocal on wanting to close this legislative file before the end of their presidency. So let's see what's going to happen there. On to a different question. In the book, you do talk about disrupted EU social policy making in 2020 and then of a re-emergence of social ambitions in 2021 and 2022. Does this mean that we can end the podcast on a positive note and say that things are improving?
Yeah. Yes, let's try to end this podcast on a positive note. Even though, first of all, the book describes how social policy initiatives remained blocked in the Council during 2020 and the first half of 2021. And this is the case for, or this was the case for legislation on pay transparency, and women on boards. It was the case for social security coordination legislation, an initiative regarding gender-based violence, just to name a few. At the same time, of course, the chronology of the book also describes some successful social policy initiatives during 2020, including, of course, the proposed legislation on minimum wages, to which Slavina just referred. But all in all, you're right, Bianca, that in all honesty, most initiatives did not seem to have a lot of teeth in 2020, as is the case, unfortunately, for the EU's new gender equality strategy. So yes, it seems fair to say that regular EU social policy making was largely disrupted in 2020. But this was, of course, also the case for policy making more generally at the EU level and to a large extent at the national level. What mattered was fighting the pandemic. What mattered was getting EU recovery on track. Maybe I'll just mention in passing that the chronology of the book, which was written this year by Angelina Atanasova, Boris Fontaidou, and Denis Bouget, has been produced every single year since 2001 in this series of books, and in my view, really represents a goldmine of information for students and researchers. Bit of publicity.
The very last question to wrap our episode up. So looking ahead, what is happening up next?
So here I think we can indeed end the podcast on a positive note. We are seeing renewed social policy ambitions this year in 2022. First of all, social affairs players have been able to gradually claw back some of the space which they lost in the European semester in the past 2 years, and I referred to that before. But there is more. The Commission's work program for 2022 and also the work program of the French presidency, which is now ongoing, announces a rather impressive and maybe surprisingly impressive social agenda. I'll just name a few. New health and safety legislation will be tabled with regard to exposure to asbestos. Long overdue legislation will be discussed regarding equal treatment, referring to pay transparency. The recent historic agreement on global tax reform will be transposed into EU legislation. And work will continue on implementing the EU digital agenda, to which we referred before. Some soft law initiatives are also worth mentioning, even though they won't end up in EU legislation. The European Commission announced a social dialogue initiative, which could be important. A council recommendation on minimum income is being prepared. And the Commission announced an initiative on long-term care. So important items are being put on the agenda, also with regard to gender-based violence, with regard to cancer screening, and Slavina already mentioned the European Year of Youth in 2022. So I'm rather optimistic in this respect, at least regards EU social policy making. So to wrap up, Bianca, maybe just leave you and especially the French presidency of the Council of the EU with a few questions. Is there or will there be a scope this year to agree on a social imbalances procedure, as the Belgian and Spanish governments have proposed a few years ago, and which, in our view, would significantly add to the EU's social governance tools? Second important question, are we going to move forward to a more permanent European unemployment benefit scheme? Third, can the Green Deal's legislative pace be revamped this year? And finally, will the ongoing conference on the future of Europe, which we haven't talked about yet, prepare the ground for more competencies for the European Union in the social field, including in health? All important questions on the agenda. And maybe I'll just add one final aspect, which has, of course, come to the fore. The French presidency of the Council of the EU included controlling migration and improving asylum policy as one of its top priorities. And I think it's important to flag that member states are showing unprecedented solidarity towards Ukrainian refugees, and so they should. For the first time ever, the Temporary Protection Directive will be activated, and the EU will pay out billions of humanitarian aid. Of course, again, whether all this will lead to structural changes in the EU's migration policy remains to be seen. In other words, Bianca, further scrutiny of EU social policy making is needed, but that's, of course, another story for yet another book.
Thank you very much, Slavina and Bart. It's been such a pleasure to have you on our show today. And just for the audience that is listening, on social imbalances procedure, by the time that you will be listening to this podcast, you'll be able to find a publication of OSE on our ETY website on social imbalances. And of course, you'll also be able to download that in the show notes.